Hey guys, welcome to episode 250. That feels significant, right? Of the JV Club with my wonderful guest, my friend and colleague, Eben Schletter. I am so delighted that he was able to do the podcast. I wanted to get a few shout outs out there. I wanted to thank Dan, Kate, Amanda, Joseph, Joshua for your emails. And I also wanted to let you know that at the end of this episode, after we wrap up with Eben, stick around because I am playing one of Suzanne Santos' new songs. She is, of course, a friend of me, a friend of the podcast. Her band, Honey Honey, has been on the podcast, as has she herself when we talked about her teenage years. If you haven't checked out those episodes, I strongly encourage you to do so. And her new album, Ruby Red, is going to be released August 11th. And the song that we're going to play at the end of the podcast is called Ghost in My Bed. I love her. I love supporting her, and I know you will feel the same. So, enjoy the episode with Eben, enjoy the bonus song of Suzanne's, and guys, just keep having a great summer, will ya?
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Say to kick things off is that I love that we both just crammed several apologies in before we even started recording. Like, listen, I'm really tired. No, I'm really tired. Well, I'm gonna be all over the place. Well, I really am gonna be all over the place. Well, okay, we'll see who's more all over the other. It's gonna be good.
I'm with you. I apologize. Disclaimers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're ready to be loopy as all get out, but I already am worst non sequitur float. Oh wait, what were we talking about? Person anyway, on this podcast, so it might be might be your most. If you can just maybe hold
am I like this?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe if that's cool. This might laser focus you in a weird way. It might be like the reverse thing happens, like we were just joking about with that whatever the highest expectation thing is like, well, you'd think that would totally derail you, but instead, for some reason, it's going to have like a weird black hole effect that sucks in all of your attention, and you'll have to keep me in line. We'll see. We'll see. Yes. You don't have to take your hat off because you're not wearing headphones.
Yes.
And I'm not the person who feels a hat should be taken off inside, but that is sort of a old-fashioned.
I guess it is.
People still have that. I think my dad still has that from being a high school teacher. I think he like made like kid like seniors take their baseball caps off when they came into class and sit down.
I hadn't realized, you know, my whole hat wearing thing. Just kind of, you know, my wife would start getting me hats, and here I'm actually going to take it off because it's actually comfortable.
He took it
off. The hat is off. As Janet can see, I have no skull, and my brain is now exposed, and it's totally disgusting.
That's shocking. I can't believe you sprung it on me right now when we're recording.
No, that's what it feels like, though, when I take it off sometimes.
I'm sure. Because
I feel like my head must be just gross.
I'm sure. Same with glasses, too, right? I mean, you sort of feel, I feel a bareness. Like, if I've been wearing sunglasses a bunch or when I never wore contacts and I just had glasses, I would feel so aware and exposed. Even though people can still see.
Yeah, it's a weird naked feeling when you get used to doing these things.
And so she started buying you hats, and then it did become the thing that feeds on itself, like everyone thinks you.
Yeah, then it's just sort of, and the hats and glasses for me, what's weird is, you know, I didn't have glasses for a long time. I vividly remember the first time I brought glasses to like a Paul F. Tompkins show.
Yeah.
And Paul was, I know he made a, we were on stage and he made a joke about how I don't really need them. He's doing it for fashion, uh-huh. which actually wasn't true.
Uh-huh. And of
so he said, take those off. And I purposely played all crappy. Uh-huh. But what happened, my dad's an optometrist and he started sending me glasses.
Okay.
And I'm like, why are you sending me these? You're at that age. You're going to need them.
Oh,
I'm like, what are you talking about?
He psychically and professionally ruled knew. That he must know.
And
so for you, it was that you were farsighted, so you started to need it more to read up close.
I still don't know whether it's far. I guess it is farsighted.
It's your dad's only an optometrist. It's great.
There's a natural, you know, your eyes change at a certain age. I'm not going to say what age that is. But mine actually went way worse than they should have. He just thought I'd normally need just reading glasses.
Right. Yeah.
And so sure enough, there was that day where I'm looking at a CD liner note, you know, the little booklet with the teeny tiny print. I'm
yeah.
Like, good God, the man's right. I need glasses. So I started wearing the ones that he got, that he would send me. And then my eyes just started slipping more and more. So it was weird because I had 20/20 vision, great vision my whole life.
Isn't that funny? And does your dad have 20/20 vision, or did he?
No, he does not have perfect vision. Although I don't know how much it might have shifted. I don't think he had glasses when he was younger either. So I think I don't remember him when I was a kid having glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So that started later too.
When you have vision that's that good, and obviously if your dad is just taking the liberty of sending you glasses without you even having to report for duty to get a test, does that mean, like, I've had to go to the optometrist yearly since I was a kid. I think I got glasses when I was in seventh grade or something. So once you're in the machine of needing them, you have to go in and, you know, get them and get your eyesight checked. Did you not get eye exams?
I barely do. Actually, I had my favorite exam because my parents don't live down here in LA. They live in the Bay Area. So when we'd go visit, he would take me in there and have the exam. But one time they came down here and he shows up with a little suitcase with lenses in it.
Oh.
And these are antiques from the 1930s.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, first of all, I was like, okay, my dad's a badass.
Yeah.
Can we swear in here?
Yes, absolutely.
If 100%. The shit comes down
and
we have no power grid, he can still do an eye examination with old school lenses, no projectors, none of that. He literally had me look. We have a little sign by our door.
Yeah.
That says something. What does it even say? I'm so punchy. It says something nice about have a nice life and have friends and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's like, is that in
have
focus?
Have a nice life like someone's dying.
It's not exactly
have a nice
what
life.
You know,
you're never going to see him again.
Eat well, nice do life. Nice things to people. I don't know. And so
whatever it actually is a major disappointment to me now. Like, after have a nice life and eat
have
well,
a nice life,
do nice
right
things
door.
To people.
Yeah, to people. Do a nice thing to somebody, not with them. Just to them. Here.
Put them through
I'm
it.
Throwing
put
money
them
through
at a really nice thing. Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, so he had you.
He had me focus on those and he just did the same thing they normally do. How about this? How about that? But literally with these little handheld lenses.
How about that?
That were super kind of cool looking.
Yeah.
And they had that, the box itself had, 30s, everything looked,
how
everything
charming.
Was designed. You opened it up. It wasn't just functional. It was like deco or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're
it's
like,
funny you would
oh,
say that because
so
I just
cool.
came back from Comic-Con on the train yesterday and walk every time I walk through Union Station, I feel myself saying, I can't control it. I feel myself saying like, they just don't make them like they used to.
It's so.
I don't even know what I mean by that, but it happens to be deco, and it is. Everything is so ornate. And I guess, do you need like a 60-foot cathedral wood beamed ceiling for a train station? I guess you don't.
No,
but it's so beautiful.
It does get into a thing of, anyone who's like a designer and realizes the art of that.
Yeah.
It changes your outlook on the world.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the train station and it looks like a cathedral and you're going to work and that's what you do every day, your entire mindset towards the world is going to be different than if you go in a I don't know what they're building down by my kids' ballet class. They're making a metro station.
Right, right.
I don't know. Is it going to be just a big gray box and you go in there and, and then
that's
your,
a great
your
point.
Whole outlook on the world changes when you're surrounded, depending on your surroundings.
That's a great point. You're absolutely right.
I do think there is a lot to all that.
And you cared more about your eyes when you saw this very deliberate,
beautifully
designed.
This is like an exam.
Yeah.
But also I know from him that as the art of that has evolved, it's very computerized now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Things are very done all that way.
This is a very weird coincidence because right the day before I left for Comic-Con, I had an eye exam and it had been a little over a year and I was due. And that's usually what brings me in now is that I realize I'm running out of contacts and they won't give me the subscription until it's a magazine. They won't give me the prescription until I have been checked to make sure that it's still the same prescription.
Right.
The strength.
Slowly, that's my problem. They're changing.
Well, let
constantly.
Me tell you a little story about a thing I'm calling my mutant power, Evan.
which is number one, yes, everything is super computerized. And I actually took, maybe I'll Instagram it when this episode comes out. I took a picture. They did a glaucoma test where they take a photograph of the back of your eye and sort of all around your eye and your optic nerve and stuff. And so it's this sort of beautiful, it looks like fractal art, you know, oh, you wow. sort of look at it and you're like, that's my eyeball. There's a lot of rainbow colors that I guess are, you know, color coded, so people smarter than I am about eyeballs know what it all means. It's all, there's a lot of it looks like a, you know, topographical map. Wow. It's really, really interesting. But Evan, my eyesight has been improving on its own for the last several years.
Benjamin Button eyes?
Yes, my eyes are turning into infant eyes. It's crazy.
Wow.
I was like, how normal is this? And he goes, it's not that common. I mean, I guess it happens, but every year for the last 4 years that I've gotten my exam, my prescription, he gives me a weaker prescription for my contact lenses.
That makes sense to me from stuff that my dad has explained, because again, I always forget.
And it has an effect, and I can still read close up. So it's not like one's degenerating and one's improving.
I always forget which one's far and near and all that
yeah.
stuff. But one of them, it's a matter of your muscles overcompensating.
Mm.
And if your muscles have been overcompensating and now over time they're relaxing,
mm-hmm.
then it's pushing it back towards better.
Oh.
Or, you know what I mean? So, like, I think.
Are you saying that I don't have a superpower? A very, very minor.
Or, that's the other.
regenerative.
Or you have a.
The tiniest bit of Wolverine. The tiniest bit
just
of Wolverine.
Just really slow.
Yeah. Please don't gouge my eyes out thinking they'll heal.
You and it's like, okay, I have a healing power just like Wolverine.
Yes.
It's going to take about a couple days for this scratch
so,
to heal.
So true for anyone. I see where you're going with this.
No, but just like maybe a day ahead.
Yeah. Not so anyone else would notice, but yeah. I'll know I heal faster.
If you and me got scratched at the same time and we did a check,
yeah,
you have
would
the superpower. It's a day earlier.
That's right.
Yours is gone. I still got a little scar there.
Yeah. Listen, it could be life-saving. A day could be all I need to not get, like, sepsis. We could both be exposed to a vicious bacteria one day before.
All these infections, all because of that one extra day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad you agree that I am a mutant with powers. That's something I really wanted to put across. It's it is really funny, though, because I thought about that at the time. I was like, how do I tell the world that my eyesight's improving? And then I forgot all about it. And then now you're podcasting and your dad's an optometrist. So
yes,
this really, really worked out for me. I'm so pleased. Please. Did you grow up in the Bay Area?
Yes.
Whereabouts in
Berkeley.
Oh, gotta love it.
Born in Walnut Creek, but we were living in Berkley. And
you were born in Walnut Creek before Walnut Creek was even Walnut Creek in the way that people think of it nowadays, which is like a pretty serious like suburb that the BART goes to. That
right.
is probably a little more of a,
I remember when
a smaller
I got
community
out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, part of I think the story was because. We were with Kaiser,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor who delivered me, because he could get free surgeries and stuff at Kaiser, at the Oakland Kaiser, he had had a surgery that had gone wrong. And so he has a permanent, like what his lip would be like up on one side.
Yeah.
Some kind of, it should have been a simple thing. My understanding is that it was sort of like, well, let's go to the Walnut Creek one.
Understand.
He was
sense.
A little skittish.
No kidding. A surgery that had gone wrong. Who wants that?
Yeah,
and who wants to even think
no
about
good.
That?
Yeah. And it was a permanent for the rest of his life disfigurement.
Well, the way you just described it with your, like, sort of pushing your finger up, it did make it look like he had a little bit more of a smile.
Mm-hmm.
Like they jokered.
On one
part.
Side.
They jokered part of him.
Yes, they did.
It wasn't an on purpose smile. It was a half finished joker. It was a smirk.
It was like a spaghetti Western joker, like where the guys don't finish their beard.
Uh-huh. You
know, they're shaving their beard halfway, and that's when the gunfight happens.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
Like, I was going to be full joking, isn't it? This man with no name walked in. Damn it.
Full joker. I love it. And so growing up in Berkeley, do you feel like you had that? I mean, that's the funny thing I always like touching on with people is that our realities as children are our realities. And so few of us have a sense of what makes them more unusual or right. less unusual or whatever that even means. But obviously, for most of us, when we think about Berkeley, we do think about this kind of special community of hippies who
yeah.
are sort of always now. Obviously, the kind of violent liberalism that was experienced not so long ago with, you know, people like burning things.
Yeah,
that doesn't feel very Berkeley to me the way I like to think of it.
No, it's a kind of complicated place, I guess. And I've seen sort of, I went to college there too. So I participated in like the anti-apartheid protests.
Mm-hmm.
And that was inspiring and discouraging at the same time, because you'd see all these different things come into play. You see
right.
people being activists and being righteous, and then you also just see the complete idiocy of people that you're trying to agree with,
yeah.
and how counterproductive it can be,
yeah.
and just oh boy. And so yeah, I had really mixed feelings about that. I was really gung-ho with all that. And then for a while I was just like, oh, there's nothing anywhere that you can be a part of that doesn't get ruined somehow.
I understand that. No, it's really hard. It is that sort of, that idea of like even the most kind of noble principles somehow fall into the hands of humans that are, when we get a little more on our ape side,
yes.
that we sort of manage to contort stuff enough that you go, like, how many times have I said to myself about someone's behavior, don't take my side.
Right.
Like, you're not making my opinion look good.
Right, right.
Even though technically we supposedly have the same opinion.
Yeah. We're agreeing on some fundamentals, and then, you know, there's just so much hypocrisy, and it's, you know.
Yeah.
And then people get very self-righteous about stuff, because I think that inside people there is a desire to, on the one hand, there's something in people that wants to lord it over other people.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that can come out in the most obvious ways of literally lording it over people.
Yeah.
Having slaves and other things that people have had. But then the other versions of it are like that kind of righteousness. It's a way of lording over people to be like, I'm better than you. You're wrong and I'm right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's like hold hands with
contempt, right? It's like, I'm holding you in contempt. Because I'm sure I figured this out and you haven't. And that's,
and
it doesn't seem like it gets the job done.
It's funny.
I
got
kind of a good way.
Berkeley exposed me to a sort of, I guess I'd call it bigotry light. It's not your hardcore, you know.
You're not full Joker. You're half Joker.
Yeah. Well, and it's also bigotry about stuff, you know, when you know, the big bigotry, of course, is racism, sexism, those things.
Yeah.
But when you see just the basic assumptions that people can make. And the thing about, I found, you know, again, I'm going to do it right now myself. You know, those people in Berkeley, here's how they are. Here's how they all are. But what happens is, I think when you are in a community that tries to be elevated and tries to be liberal and understanding, you fall into other presumptions that you are not noticing that you're falling into.
Yeah.
A couple things can happen. Number one is the group that you are protecting, that you're saying, hey, these people have been screwed over. Now none of them can do any wrong ever, mm-hmm. which is sort of like, well, no, that's not right either.
Yeah.
But then there's also things of like, I had a experience unrelated to political things and mm-hmm. all that, but I just realized, oh, that's weird. Now I see why this happened.
Yeah.
So my very first album was, I was in a very bad place in life, and I'd been through a bunch of stuff, and I had written songs over the years about it. I had friends that had passed away, all this stuff. And every song I wrote on that record came from all of these places, right?
Yeah.
And my dad, my dad is like, you know, here, I'll check your eyes. Hey, my son does music. Check out this record, you know. Oh, boy. So, but one of his patients had listened to the record, and her take on it was that it wasn't honest because it's country songs, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, you can tell he's never, you know, none of that stuff is based on his experience. You know, Johnny Cash, everything he's saying is based on experience.
Right.
But not what, you know, your son, obviously. Because again, she's going, oh, son of an optometrist.
Right.
He can't have been through anything.
Right.
And it's like, guess what? Johnny Cash didn't, Folsom, he saw, that's not, no.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like, oh, you completely misjudged that.
Yeah.
And again, it's her perception of, you know, I know what people who suffer go through.
Right.
And a son of a optometrist can't go through anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I totally do.
So so many layers of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then of course the big hypocrisy that was just blatant going to college at, in Berkeley was the sexism of like, you've got the liberal guys who are super liberal. And, but when it comes to women, it's still like, you're still the dumb jocks that were in my high school.
God, I never, that's fascinating.
You literally just said that's you're at this protest to pick up chicks.
Oh,
go away. We're
no.
here protesting apartheid. And you're here, where's the babes at?
That's no. not,
are you serious?
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff was just rampant.
Yeah.
So I'm just, that's oh so God, there's no winning.
Is that what your high school was like? Like you were talking about the jocks. So you, what was
there
the
were
high
jocks
school
at my, I went to Piedmont High School. So we were living. My childhood was in Berkeley,
And Piedmont is more Oakland. Yeah,
Piedmont is a little suburb in between. I had never heard of it. So I had gone through sixth grade, and my parents said we're moving to Piedmont. I'm going, but I like California. No, it's just down the 13. It's not far. I didn't realize it because I was so young, but they had busing. So my kindergarten through sixth grade was completely mixed diversity, racially.
Me too.
And I didn't really think about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I get to Piedmont and it's all white people.
Oh, interesting.
And then, and also when I was in first through third grade, my teachers had both, they were from the South. A black woman and a white woman. Mm-hmm. Both of them had been, they had been in marches with Martin Luther King, both these women.
Yeah.
So we did Martin Luther King's birthday. We saw films of him doing speeches, etc. And so when I get to Piedmont, we have a unit and they start showing Martin Luther King delivering a speech. And I can't remember which one it was precisely, but it's one where a lot of times he'd do a speech, and because it came out of the churches, you've got the people around him, he'd make a point and you'd get right on.
Oh, yeah.
All
yeah.
that surrounding circumstance of it. And all anyone did after we saw that was just make fun. And they were laughing at it, giggling at it. And that's all, that their whole takeaway of everything they just saw was like, hey, those guys are all going right on after, and just making fun of that. And I was just like horrified.
No kidding.
And, it was a big, that was, and I'd never heard the word kike, and my older sister was the first one in our family to hear the word kike when we moved to Piedmont, and she pissed this guy off because he called her a kike, and she's like, what's that? And he's like, it's a Jew. And she's like, really? And he's like, yeah. And she started laughing. He's like, what's so funny? And she's like, that's a really weird word. How does that? I don't get the connection to what that means.
Yeah.
And it's just a silly,
I guess I don't either. Word. It's not one that you can immediately see the like grotesque, awful etymology of right away.
And also she was really into Michael Jackson. And so they called her an N-word lover.
Oh, that's so
first
outrageous.
Time we heard that. And this was, of course,
and this is just, again, to reiterate, so not far from Berkeley and Oakland.
15-minute drive. It's,
I wonder if that's part of it, is that because close, they look at Oakland and go like, ooh, Oakland, that's full of...
Some of them literally thought Oakland's going to come invade them.
Oh, God.
like it's the
I
Reds.
Wish I could say that's
like
past.
A Red scare.
But yeah, seriously.
No, it was crazy. I'm sure
their biggest fear was Oakland expanding to include possibly having, you know, black families moving into their neck of the woods.
It was very weird. And my understanding, though, years later, I think it has grown more liberal because I think, as you know,
they started
calling it Little Israel. The people that were there were like, it's becoming Little Israel around here. More Jews moved in, more Asian people moved in.
And, like, sounds pretty good. Sounding pretty good to me.
I think they went from one black person in the school to two.
Yeah.
And it's slowly getting there. But
let me clarify, and this is probably not interesting for anyone but me, but is there a Piedmont like road that's in Oakland or Berkeley? That, because I for some reason went to therapy. I don't know why I was so far away. I'm sure it was a Kaiser thing where they're like, this is the only, I don't know why. But at one point in my early 20s, I was going to a therapist and I thought of it as going to a therapist in Piedmont. And I'm wondering if I was going to a therapist on Piedmont in a neighborhood they were calling Piedmont as if it were its own thing.
If it's what I'm thinking of, there's a Piedmont Avenue, which is actually in Oakland. Then there's an Oakland Avenue, which is actually in Piedmont.
Oh, that. to help
now,
matters.
Here's the important tangent here. Piedmont Avenue in Oakland is home of Fenton's, the world's greatest ice cream.
That is where that is near where my therapist was.
Okay.
It was near Fenton's, for sure.
So that's right next to Piedmont.
Gotcha.
Some people think it's part of Piedmont, but technically you're in Oakland there, but it's really, really like, you know, 10-minute on foot to the borderline there.
Gotcha.
So yeah, that's very close.
And so did you experience, Fentons. Did you feel like you,
oh, okay, go on.
Delicious, yes. Delicious Fentons.
It's only the best.
Do you feel like you experienced anti-Semitism the way she did by being called that? And was that something that was kind of poking around in the shadows, or?
I was definitely aware of it, and I didn't get it as directly as she did. We both had similar experiences of, so she's getting a hard time for liking Michael Jackson, right? And then Off the Wall comes out. And all of a sudden, they're playing Michael Jackson at the rallies, right. And everyone's acting like they never said anything to her. Mm-hmm. And similarly with me, I when I moved to Piedmont is when I started getting into my punk rock phase.
Do you feel like those things are connected at all? Like it was that something evolved, the interest was there, and then did it evolve through the sort of like, how do I not, look, I can't change the color of my skin, but I'm feeling shame about this type of person, and I'm angry about it, and this is a way of expressing, like, I'm not this.
It was a lot of different, I felt out of place instantly, and that was a huge part of it. Also, I just got teased and harassed a lot. I was very small. I was always, like, the smallest in my class, and just got made fun of a lot and everything. So I felt very much like an outcast, and then I made just a few friends, just had a few friends, and also, through other influences before that, I was really into, it's funny, my interest in music kind of evolved chronologically.
Oh, yeah?
I was maybe a little bit out of order. I was really into, of course, being a kid in Berkeley, I was exposed to the Beatles like crazy.
Sure.
And then my music, there was a diversion because me and my older sister had an issue.
Uh-huh.
And that, my parents would always make me do whatever she's doing. Oh, take Evan with you, blah, blah. And to the point where, you know, now I look at it as a parent and go, of course, you're destroying her identity. What
yes,
are you doing?
Yes.
So she hated me.
Oh, yeah.
And it also got to the point where I basically had to ask her for permission to like certain music.
Aww. She was
Michael Jackson is mine.
I totally get that. I feel like I had that with friendships. I've said this before on the podcast. I don't have siblings, but I've brought this up, this idea that there's an ownership when you're younger because of your identity becomes so precious, and whatever you're building, you're so passionate about, you don't want to share it.
Right.
And there's a selfishness even that extends beyond siblings, I think, and into friendships, to where I was like, I guess I just felt like I couldn't love that band because my friend loved them and somehow it belonged to them.
It's, yeah. And that,
so I love that yours is a step further where you actually had to permission, denied.
Can I like Queen? Yeah, you can like Queen. So I was really into Queen.
So funny. Do you guys laugh about that now?
Oh yeah, totally.
It's so great.
And it pushed us in different, and then later, of course, you know, it's almost like we got pushed in these different directions, and then later we can come back and go, well,
let me show you this.
Let me show you what I found on that side of the mountain.
Great.
Ennio Morricone. Check that out. And you know, cause I was being a soundtrack nerd from a young age, that was gold for her. She's like, yeah, have at it. Boring. She's listening to she was listening to all the cool stuff. She was like right there with the Parliament, Funkadelic, the Silvers, all this stuff. And I wasn't allowed to listen. Certain things were kind of grandfathered in, like the Beatles.
I love this.
So the Beatles were just sort of like, too late. We've already been listening to the Beatles. So no one gets to say one thing or the other about that. But it kind of started going chronologically because, and this was a TV influence too. I watched way too much TV. But they used to have, like, every year there'd be a history of rock and roll kind of documentary on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to when I said chronological, I literally, I went through a 50s phase and then a 60s phase. Mm-hmm. I didn't really go through a 70s phase because I was in, you know, that was all just current to me at the time I was little. But having gone through the 60s phase, I was into the Beatles on the activist level, and Bob Dylan and all that stuff on the activist level.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a big moment for me. My parents took me to The Deer Hunter.
Whoa. Which, how old were you?
Like 12, just
That's
turned
pretty
12.
Young, huh?
Yeah, and by the way, Hunter. I reenacted this on my podcast.
Oh my gosh.
Amazing. I reenacted some childhood stuff on my podcast and have my kids play me.
Oh, I love that.
But that movie freaked me the fuck out. But then at the same time, it made me really go, what's the deal with this Vietnam War? And read more about it. And then really have an understanding of what the music was saying. And, you know, when I listened to Woodstock and all that stuff, it's not just a bunch of tunes. It's the activism of it and the anti-war thing of it. And so then you move to a place like Piedmont. And on the one hand... Oh, and I remember there was this one girl, Daisy. I remember I'm there in middle school, and I hear screaming, like hundreds of people screaming, not like in pain, but just like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
And I go out, and this girl is in all pink, like early punk rock, new wave, crazy fucking awesome outfit.
Yes.
And there's like three stories. This school is like three story of balcony, and people are all just like, oh my God, look at her. And just like the entire population of a school just trying to shame her.
Oh no.
It was like, I was just, and I felt like I'm the little guy who get, it's like, what do you say to, it was like being at a Nuremberg rally.
Yeah.
And what do? Go, hey, you're all assholes, every single one of you. And I was just like, and I just wanted to, you know, I didn't know her at all.
Yeah.
I got to know her later in high school, but I was just like, I wished I could just go, no, you're cool. Fuck all of them.
Yeah.
And that got me so furious. And then someone picked on me again. I'm just like, fuck it. And then so me and this one friend of mine, we just started naturally getting into, you know, Black Flag had come out. And it's like, that just spoke to me hugely. But then it also added, because I did get a sense with the 60s stuff, you know, I think one of the great victories for the powers that be is that they have painted the 60s to be about hippy-dippy kumbaya instead of the activism that it really was. Right. And even I fell prey to that. It's like, oh, the hippies, they didn't really do anything. It's peace and love. Fuck that. You need to say fuck you. And so so then it started getting into that. And so I was one of probably, I guess, maybe 6 to 8 punk rockers in Piedmont.
Yeah.
And then I also realized that I was very lucky to be in Piedmont because my friends who I'd left behind in Berkeley, if you were punk rock there, you'd get beat up.
Oh, yeah?
But in Piedmont, you see, they're very isolated. And here's little wimpy me with my, like, crappy version of spiked hair and whatever. Uh-huh. And they wouldn't fight me because I think you could sense there was, like, this fear. Like, he's a punk rocker. He could kill us. Uh-huh. No, actually, you could, like, look at me the wrong way and you'll snap my neck. Right. But okay, I'll take that. That's fine.
Yeah.
So I didn't, it was always just kind of, but I took a ton of crap for, like, having the torn up shirt that had the Clash scrawled on it. The Clash. And you're a faggot. And, you know, they'd say that. I got that all the time. And then, of course, two years later. Rock at the Casbah. Anyone want to give me an apology now?
Yeah.
No? Okay.
Strangely silent. Huh.
Then
interesting.
Back to imagining the end of the movie If with me on the roof of this school. Screw all of you people.
Were you a good student, or was part of the kind of fuck the system?
At first it was fuck the system.
Yeah.
And I was furious, and I had a realization where, because I was getting not very good grades, there was a bunch of teachers I also didn't like. And also, got to say, Piedmont, again, this weird, what a weird experience going there. I always say that it made me understand Dave Lynch better. If you've never been to Piedmont or you don't know what I'm talking about, it's just the opening, near opening shot of Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
Where it's the picket fence and the high, and then the camera goes into the ground. With the and it's just like, that's it. That's Piedmont.
Yeah.
Yeah, at first I wasn't getting great grades, and then I'm looking around going, wait a minute, I saw a test from one of these dumb jocks who gave me a hard time all the time, who later I would see at a reunion. I'll get to that later.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait.
I only was able to make it to one reunion. It was so bizarre.
I've never been to one.
Made my life hell.
Please tell me that
driving about a bunch of drunk. I'm the designated driver. I had no seats in the car because I carried drums and stuff back then. I wasn't expecting anyone to be
there.
So these guys are just drunkenly rolling around. Like, how am I driving all these assholes around?
That's so
but
funny.
But it was actually great. But so then, I realized I'm getting the same grades as that guy.
Right.
And I'm supposed to be the smart guy. I'm all better than them, but I'm not because, you know, no. You know what? I'm going to actually pay attention.
Yeah.
And all I had to do to turn my grades around was like stop doodling and actually listen to the guy.
Yeah.
And even if I didn't like him, there was one teacher who hated me because, you know, he instantly saw the hair.
Mm-hmm. He's like, I got your number, buddy.
Punk.
Yeah.
And there was several that were like that. And then another one that was like the opposite. There's my science teacher was just the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
She just saw all of that as for what it was. She really appreciated like, oh, kids these days, look, you know, we had hippies in my day and look at them doing, you know, and she appreciated it. And this guy that I was in a band with, perfect goofus and gallant with the science teachers. One science teacher, he would just sit in the back of the room. He was very cocky about it because he was a fucking genius.
Yeah.
And he would just sit there and then they'd say, where's your textbook? You don't have your textbook here. I don't see half the kids in this room don't have their textbook. I don't see why you're giving me a hard time. And so the guy got furious. Meanwhile, my other teacher, Mrs. Phillips, I had a conversation. She goes, oh, I see what your friend is doing in the back. He's sitting there blatantly reading a book, not listening to a word I'm saying. But I'll tell you something. I know the science fiction writer he's reading, and he's very good. And as long as he keeps getting the grades he's getting on the tests,
nice.
I don't care what he does.
Nice, nice.
She totally like, I see what you're doing. You're being cocky.
Yep.
But she was like, but he's smart.
Clearly,
He was reading like really
Heinlein
intense.
Or something. Or,
And he was reading, I don't, the authors he was, it's like, Foundation trilogy? Oh, that's nothing. I'm reading this. I'm like, okay. He's like, so she respected that. And she's like, I'm not, you know.
Yeah. My school was a public school and I guess a public but college prep school put into one. One's called University High School and that's the college prep one. And then the other one was just Rincon. And there were all of my friends that I hung out with when I was like very kind of goth punk were so incredibly smart and they all went to UHS and they were all like at the top of their class at UHS and they were walking in wearing, you know, Revolting Cox t-shirts that they were going to have that they would be sent home for wearing, but then they would just like still ace the test. There was just a lot of, that's why I asked, because I was interested to see if you had that kind of experience of like, yeah, actually it being punk rock actually didn't really affect in the end, you know, whether I was a good student.
No, it actually turned things around. Because that was the other thing is, there were some guys a grade above me, and I was like, I want to be friends with these people. They seem so cool.
Yeah.
And it turns out they were, and super hyper intelligent.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was a big lifesaver. Because then when you get into your partying and all of that stuff, there's a whole other realm of doing that. You're not just, you know, of course you're doing stupid, you're young and dumb and you're doing stupid things, but you're doing it with smarter people. Mm-hmm. And so you don't find yourself doing some of the same, you know, we didn't have puking parties to see how much we could puke, like with the job, you know.
Right, right.
We just, you know.
Yeah. No, same
actually,
thing.
I'll correct that. We did eventually do have one of those, but we did it because it was for a video shoot and a friend wanted to do a movie. So he's like, we're doing a song called Get Wasted and we got to get footage of people
there's
puking.
An artistic value
so we are doing this for
of
a
course,
purpose.
Of
we're
course.
Not doing this just because this
it's
is what we do
creative
every
content.
Weekend.
That's amazing. Oh, that reminds me actually when you said the video shoot. So maybe I'm wrong because I loved soundtracks also, but when I think about soundtracks as a teenager, for me, that just meant, you know, I loved the Pretty in Pink soundtrack or I loved, you know, that meant like, oh, that's how I found out who Simple Minds were or, you know, anything like that. Oh, Cat Stevens and the Harold and Maude soundtrack. Like,
right.
I don't, and I would buy, I remember I bought the Mission soundtrack as one of the first CDs I bought, which is Ennio Morricone.
Good choice.
And so I definitely remember, and I did get to the place where, you know, quickly, if a movie was important enough for me and had that sort of like visceral impact that movies especially did when I was a teenager more than any other time in my life. I needed to have the soundtrack to be completist, you know, needed to have it so I could sort of feel like I was still in the movie, even if I was just walking down the street with my Walkman on. But all that being said, I don't think that I had a true appreciation for, you know, composing a soundtrack to a film. Like, do you, particularly because of what you do now too, do you feel like you're unusual in that way? Like, how young were you, and when did you, and your understanding of like, oh, this music bed has a tremendous impact on how the scene's making me feel. Like, do you feel like you had an understanding of that on that kind of granular level then?
I kind of, well, yeah, what happened was the very, well, technically the very first film related purchase I made was Sergeant Pepper.
Of course.
Because I wanted to, because I was obsessed with Yellow Submarine. And again, it's hard to explain to, you know, like my kids, when there was no VHS and no DVD, what's a VHS, Dad? Never mind. Never mind.
don't make me go further back than that. This is humiliating.
But I remember like seeing a snippet of Yellow Submarine on TV when it aired one time. And it was one of these local channels that had terrible reception. And I'm watching it. It's like... And it's like, you see the blue meanies, oh my God, what is this?
How
and it's
taunting.
And so eventually my dad took me to see it at the Rialto 4 in Berkeley, which was this little hole in the wall. The guy eventually ended up, I think, owning the Grand Lake Theater and stuff. But he had this wonderful little theater, the Rialto 4, where it was like four little tiny films. Anyway, so I saw Yellow Submarine and I was just like, holy, blew my mind. So I immediately wanted everything in it. So when I got the Yellow so I got Sergeant Pepper, but I also got the Yellow Submarine soundtrack, which had some of the score tracks on it. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. Then Rocky came out, and of course, Gonna Fly Now is a big hit, and I wanted that. And so I got, you know, I don't want just the little record, I want the big record. And so I got that, and I actually listened to the whole thing, and my favorite parts were not Gonna Fly Now. Mm. And so that started it, and then Star Wars was the next thing that made me go, okay, now I'm listening to Star Wars music and not just the main theme and Cantina Band. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to listen to some of the other stuff. And then the final, like just putting it over, was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And that just made me go, okay, now I'm just looking for, now I'm literally going through the soundtrack section, which back then was all alphabetical.
Sure.
So you'd literally, you'd look down the whole thing and go,
you know what you were looking for. You would just have to browse.
I have to go from A and go all the way to Z.
Yes.
And I'm looking for anything that this Ennio Morricone guy did. Mm-hmm. Anything. And I remember one of them, I'm so dumb. I pull one, I go, I open it, I look, Il Buono, Il Gatto, Il Cattivo. What the hell is that? Well, that's not what I'm looking for. I wanted The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Anyway, and I'm going through. And so sure enough, I started learning some Italian stuff because I went back and went, oh my God, that was here.
Yeah.
And so I ended up like, because I was such a collector, I'd get like multiple pressings because it had a different cover. And it was hard to find his stuff. And so I would just be like, what's this weird movie?
Sure.
And so I started having a rule of like, I didn't want to get a soundtrack unless I'd seen the movie. And then I soon had to break that because Morricone has hundreds and you can't even, you know, where would you even see them?
Yeah.
So then it became sort of after a while when more really cool video houses started proliferating. Like I think there's one Le Video in San Francisco, mm-hmm, and they have a huge foreign section.
Oh yeah,
that was my mission, was to start matching up the movie with these scores that I had gotten and start seeing those.
Okay,
and that turned me on to other directors that I never would have, like Sergio Corbucci and Pasolini and all these other films that I never would have been exposed to. It all came from soundtracks and also classical music. I saw 2001, got that score album, mm-hmm, and then I'm listening to it and I'm going, wait, what? This is an excerpt from. This wasn't written for the movie. This is somebody's modern classical piece. Right. Well, I got to get that whole thing now.
Yeah.
So the Ligeti stuff, that. Or Ligeti, however you pronounce his name. So it just started opening up all that kind of thing. So
what are your thoughts on, I have so many. This has been, by the way, very linear, I think, overall, considering
yes, we haven't
for both
jumped
of us.
Off
I'm proud
any
of us
tangents.
Both. It's almost bittersweet. Okay, these are the two things I have on my mind. Number one, I'm fascinated by the idea of listening to a soundtrack backwards and forwards, so to speak, and then matching the film afterwards, only because I think I've only done that twice, and it's because I was obsessed with the Never Cry Wolf soundtrack, which is...
Oh, yeah.
And that's Mark Isham.
Yeah.
And he the CD of that was sold, was it's three of his films that he scored. So it's that,
I remember that
The
album.
Life and Times of Harvey Milk,
yes,
and Mrs. Sofol. And I just had never seen either Life and Times of Harvey Milk or Mrs. Sofol. But I listened to that. That was the thing I listened to day and night. Ah. I just listened to it all the time. I have so many. Now I have like this palimpsest of like layered memories. When a certain thing will play, when a certain track from that album will play, I'll think of like five memories at once.
Wow. Because
it's like, oh, that trip to Mount Lemmon. Oh, when I was in Flagstaff crunching through the snow. Oh, when that guy broke up with me. Oh, when, and so it all kind of floods, which is one of my favorite things about it. And when I finally saw the movies that the music went along with, it was uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I was like, these are my special songs.
Yeah, what are you doing here?
Diane Keaton, get out of here, which I've never said and never thought I would say about the charming Diane Keaton. So did any of that, or were you so fascinated by the whole process and the exchange between the two that for you it was kind of an intellectual, like, oh my God, this is so fascinating. I heard this and now I'm seeing where it fits.
Yeah, I really liked seeing how it got used and certain, sometimes a lot of times like my favorite tracks on the record would either not be in there or they'd be way in the background. That was something that I noticed a lot. You're really?
This
that
was
awesome
even on
piece
here?
Of music? One that kind of happened in reverse is Morricone's score to John Carpenter's The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's
God,
a lot of stuff that didn't end up in the movie.
Interesting.
And I think there's one of my favorite tracks on that album actually ended up in The Hateful Eight.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
they're like, listen, we might as well.
That's one issue I have with Tarantino. It's not really an issue, but I'm such a soundtrack nerd.
I feel that the song belongs
all the time.
The song belongs to me in the place that it originated where I saw it.
There's a part of me, that's like, it's discombobulating in that way. But if I wasn't a soundtrack nerd, I don't think it would bother me because it would just be a piece of music and I'd be in the story.
Yep.
But I'm sitting there watching going, oh, Death Rides a Horse. Oh, he's using Death Rides a Horse. Okay, what was it? What did the guy say?
Right.
Okay. Where were we? So it pulls me out of it sometimes because I recognize
perfect sense.
Him.
That makes perfect sense. And then, my other question was, I was just thinking about, I have had soundtracks on the mind too, because for some reason, like it was a thing where I went down the rabbit hole of like listening to a snippet of something and then that reminding me of the Blade Runner soundtrack and then needing to listen to that and then that reminding me. So it's been on my, and so even just down to Comic-Con, that was really on my mind. But are there soundtracks that other people laud that it's like, oh, why is this? But you're like, why is this soundtrack popping out for the most people who aren't into soundtracks in a way that others don't? Like, do you find yourself kind of going, well, I kind of wish that weren't rising to the top. It's not that
interesting.
Great.
Well, I guess I don't know if it's quite like that for me, but I will. I mean, there's certain soundtracks that now this is later. This is like that I would notice that they get temp scored a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first big one that I was aware of like that was The Natural.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, but it's not always soundtracks. I remember when I first started working doing TV music, I could tell there'd be like, here's the flavor of the year. I'm going to be asked to imitate this guy all year.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm going to be asked to imitate that score all year and whatever. So The Natural was actually well before I started doing this for a living. It's a good score, but it got temped into a whole bunch of stuff. And there's an interview with Randy Newman where apparently his friends would tease him because other scores would like win an Oscar that were clearly imitating that.
Oh, yeah.
And honestly, it's not really the composer's fault at that point. It's like you're there, you're hired to do a thing, and they temp scored it with that, and you're trying to put your own stamp on it. But they're like, no, get a little closer to the temp, you know, or you're fired. So
that's a really good point.
You want to keep your kids in school?
Yeah. Change one note. I want it to sound like this before one note.
I think that happened with 300. I think that we got
there was a
scandal. I think to the point where I think they actually did a little apology about the score somewhere on the credits or something.
Yeah.
There was a lawsuit or whatever. I don't know.
It does stink because it's like if you feel like if the filmmaker is smart or that. I guess, I mean, if it's a studio, it's a studio and there's nothing that can be done about that. But you want the soundtrack. I guess I'm saying this as a creative person, but I just can't imagine wanting to sound like the ideal hope would be I've created this new thing that if anything, that's the pressure is,
you would think that
what if my thing sounds too much like something else rather than like, yes, boss, I will make this sound as close to this as possible.
I know it makes no sense to me. There was one director I worked with who actually said, and he always liked having, you know, licensing pop songs and a lot of his stuff. And of course, when they do that, it's always at the moments you would normally have score. So like you're really, any moment you're that like, oh God, I can really do some stuff with the music here. Oh no, we're going to throw that song in there.
Also, I just say, that's so tricky because you got to really know what you're doing with that because often it becomes so maudlin. If the lyrics are too much about what's going on, like they go out, then you're like, ew, now this is a music video.
Yeah.
And if they're not enough, they don't feel germane enough, then you're like, why are they playing this now? Like it is... That's dicey for me.
Yeah, I would really rather have
orchestration, I think, that's like tailor-made for it.
And then it's also like your ear can only take in so much. So there's a lot of movies that I get taken out of. I'm like, am I supposed to be listening to the lyrics right now? Am I supposed to be listening to your dialogue right now? Because I'm hearing both at the same time.
Yeah.
And well, this is so satisfying. Like an old man.
I'm sure you've had these conversations all the time, but this is so satisfying to me.
But it does. It drives me nuts. And certain people have nailed doing that. I mean, Martin Scorsese did it masterfully. Stanley Kubrick did it masterfully. I mean, there's a little bits of original composition in his movies, but like after Spartacus, it's like all bets are off. Everything is flown in from
right.
But you know, when you look at it and it works. What are you going to do?
Well,
people do a great job with it.
And then also like his style, his visual style is so commanding, and he's probably also balancing it out with the fact that like it's arresting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're going to be watching what's happening on screen, whether or not you're listening to a song that, you know, wasn't written for it. But not in the same way that, you know, like a TV show that just has like two teenagers trying to work through their problems.
Right. And so then you're
probably
going to
get distracted. Yeah.
And well, the other thing that to me made it work with Stanley Kubrick movies is I've always felt like the whole tone of all of his movies, it's almost like you are looking at it from the point of view, you're looking at the story.
Yeah.
You're not in the, it's not like a John Cassavetes movie where you're like in the living room with the emotion.
Right, right.
You're like a scientist looking, look at these strange human beings and their idiocy.
More.
So you're very distanced.
It's very, now that we know as much as we do about autism, it makes so much sense. Like his musical choices make a different kind of sense to me, assuming that's me taking the leap that I am accepting what other people have posited, which was that he very likely had some form of Asperger's, for example. And when I think about that now, particularly with the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, which I was obsessed with in high school.
Oh yeah, me too.
That my boyfriend's brother is autistic, and so we have a lot of conversations about this kind of stuff. But the idea of the synthesized Beethoven, like all of that stuff now, and it could be that I'm reverse engineering it, because I have ideas now about what that means, but it kind of makes sense to me. And exactly what you said about sort of holding it at arm's length a little bit more and looking at it from that distance that's really interesting.
And that's funny you shared your assessment. I was really into that score, and I was so excited when Wendy Carlos released, because again,
Tron soundtrack to me is like, that's also like my favorite movie ever.
I love her stuff so much.
So special.
And there's a bunch of stuff she wrote for The Shining and for Clockwork Orange that didn't make it into the movie.
Yeah.
But into the movies. And she's released them all later. There's like a 2-disc set of her stuff.
And then there's a version of Clockwork Orange
that's
into.
Got everything on it.
Oh,
but that stuff was... And that's, you know, it's technically original for the movie, even though it's covers, basically.
Right.
But when you're looking at it from this sort of antiseptic look at the human race, especially 2001, of course it totally works to be pulling from pre-existing stuff, but you're not scoring it at that point. So it's not really a score. It's not functioning the way a score does.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different type of way of using music with images to me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
On
it's like a collage almost.
It is. It's like a collage. Yeah. What I used to call it, and it's DJing your movie.
Fair.
And it's, you're not scoring it, you're DJing it.
Fair.
You're like, put this up against it. And mm-hmm. I use that term more, in a way, Kubrick and Scorsese are not DJing it.
Right.
That's more when people are like, hey, put a cool song in, then they're DJing
it.
Those guys, it's more like a collage, like what you're saying, is like they're going, because they want the weight, they want that song that they're placing to still have its connotations and its and what it means.
Right.
So like in 2001, the Blue Danube is not just the juxtaposition of that era. he wants you picturing the wigs and the pasty face makeup and the whole thing, and now you're looking at a space station.
Right.
So it's a shorthand of going, we went through that phase, now we got to here.
Yeah.
So all that stuff is part of it. And so that's why, my brain is sort of too trained to think of all those connotations. So when I see a movie that's just kind of like, oh, and then we'll put a cool song here, I'm like, well, what's this song doing for the story? And unfortunately, the answer half the time is nothing. Oh, so this gets me back to that one director. He says, it won't sound important if it's not something that people have heard already.
Wow.
He wanted his movie to sound important.
Idea.
And to me, that was, it's like, to me, your movie doesn't sound important if it doesn't have an original score because it doesn't have its own soul.
Yeah.
If it all just sounds like other stuff, then it's less important as opposed to like, you know, Star Wars is important because it has its own theme.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff would, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, with big studio films, it bugs me less with them too, because it's really become over the years a real thorn in my side when it's like low budget indie filmmakers and they fight the process of like, I used to be so like gung ho with indie filmmaking and just like, yeah, let's do it. We're going to put a show on in the garage.
Right.
I'll bring the score. You do that. And we'll put our heads together, make a cool thing. And then you get the whole like, well, no, I was thinking, you mean, and you're like, really? Really? Yeah. Well, I was, you know, how about let's do imitate the temp more.
Listen, like, really? I love James Blunt and I just want him all throughout my movie. I want him all throughout my indie movie.
At least with a big film company, I respect the fact that they're going, listen, we're spending $40 fucking million on this thing.
Right.
And so we don't want to take any chances. Right. So yeah, it'll be safe and whatever, and maybe it won't be risky. And where's your risk taking? Okay, you risk your $40 million.
Right.
We're
right.
putting shit tons of money into this thing.
It.
And so we're gonna gonna do it, cover our assets.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. But when you're an indie filmmaker and you're just scraping it up together, I kind of slowed down on doing indie films for people because I was always like, yeah, I'm there. We don't have any money. That's okay. I'm with you.
Yeah.
And then you're like, why am I doing this?
Oh, God.
It's like, I could go through this and get paid for it.
Oh, totally.
So
totally.
I kind of stopped. There's a tangent for you.
Oh, that's such a fascinating tangent, though. Yeah. In fact, I was going to say, I wanted to make sure to ask when you started playing instruments. As well, because I think we know that you were in a band with some people, but when did that start?
Well, I started taking piano lessons when my big sister started taking.
What a surprise!
You're taking piano lessons. Have Evan take piano lessons too, so you don't have any identity in yourself as a human being. Okay, so that was probably around third grade.
Mm-hmm.
Took piano. Oh, and then I'm going to sound like an old man again. These days, they just don't do stuff like they used to. There was an after-school program. After school, I'd get on a bus. We'd go about, 10 minutes away. There was a church, and they had this whole after-school program that was all music.
Nice.
And you would switch, and you'd take like two different classes, and then you'd end up in a choir class where everyone would have to sing together. So I took recorder, I took clarinet, I took saxophone.
What a neat program.
And then I also had a piano teacher. Our piano teacher was great, and he made the mistake of showing me how to improv. Mm. And I say mistake because that made me like, I was like, I want to play the Star Wars theme. Well, let me show you how to forget. And he showed me how to, if you look at the chords on the top here, and because I'd play stuff by ear.
Yeah.
And what that started frustrating him because it really screwed up my sight reading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I'm not a good sight reader because I was, as a kid, I was
I'm
just
terrible.
Like lazy. And I was like, well, I know how the melody goes in my head, and I can just look at this and get the chords.
Yeah.
So look, I'm playing it.
I would get castigated for that,
too. And he's like, you're not reading it,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but he would do these, most piano teachers will have their kids all do a recital at some point, right? So he would do the recital, would go to his, he had a flat that he shared with some people, and it was a big flat, and you'd do the recital, but he also would have this jam session. There'd be instruments like all over the place.
That is so awesome.
And it'd be
awesome.
Just pick something up, whatever it is. Just pick it up. I don't know how to play it. Well, just play on it and figure it out.
That's great.
And so I think that made me just look at instruments as a thing not to be afraid of.
Sure.
You didn't look at it and go, well, I don't know how to do that. It was like, try it and see what you can do with it.
That.
And that really made a huge impact.
Oh my God, I love that.
And one frustration I have is my parents, this is one of those light, the things you wish you could do in life. My parents ran into him a long time ago now, but not so long enough ago that I wasn't doing what I do now for a living. And he was like, oh, I feel bad. I don't think I did good job with him because, you know, I didn't really teach him the basics because he felt he failed me because he never did get me sight reading the way that I should have and all that stuff. And it's like, I wish I was there to go, are you fucking kidding me? He taught me, you know, the way he made it so I could just play whatever I had in my
mind. It's like he gave you he opened the door to the soul of what it is to be a musician, whether or not the technical, like, math of reading notes. You could do that anywhere at any time.
Although I found out you kind of can't later.
So he did fail you.
I've tried.
Oh, okay. So he did fail.
I did try because I did go through, you know, I should get better at sight reading. And I'm like, I'm still slow at it. And it's like, I know that if I really worked at it, I could get up to speed.
But why do you feel you should?
I don't have that kind of time.
But like, what do you feel? But what do you feel you're missing? Is it the bare fact of knowing that about yourself, or do you feel it's holding you back in some real way?
I don't feel, well, certain aspects, sometimes I feel it can be, well, it's really not, because it depends on what.
Yeah, so fuck it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I've had to make the decision.
That's just semantics. It's like, then it's like feeling like, I should have taken that one class in college. Like, well no, you're not using it.
It's one of those, you have to be comfortable what kind of animal you are. This friend of mine, Ron Suris, is a composer, and he got me, when I first came down here, I was so like, I'm not classically trained. And then I play in bands. I used to play in bands. I was a drummer. And then I started playing in bands here drumming, but it was a whole other level. I was arranging for them, then I'd be the drummer. And I'm not a good enough drummer to play the kind of stuff. Punk rock,
yeah.
I can do that.
Right.
But, and I started feeling really self-conscious. And he's like, well, you're not one of these guys who ever was like, I'm going to be Hal Blaine or somebody sat and practiced every day.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you know, you got to just be comfortable with what kind of animal you are. And so the sight reading is part of that too. I'm not the kind of guy who is going to be like, oh, hey, we're doing a thing here. Here's a chart. Boom. We're going to play a bunch of these standards. Go play with us.
Right.
That's not really my bag. Yeah. You know?
And it's also, and if it were, you would be doing that.
I would have done that. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So exactly. It's sort of.
But sometimes that happens with me where I've made these decisions and I feel so happy with my choices in my life. And then I see someone else doing something that's just, you know, in the peripheral of the periphery of what I could have put more time into, and they seem happy. And so for just that afternoon, I'm like, oh, I want that.
Right.
Oh, I should have been that.
You should have been doing
that. And then I go home and say that. And then someone's like, but I mean, wouldn't you have done that if you really do that now? No, I guess you're right.
Well, yeah,
that's a really good point. But they seemed like they were so happy reading that music.
Yes.
You know?
And it is a thing where, it took me a long time to not feel self-conscious about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because there's, I'm stuck on, in fact, I was going to reenact this too, because I do my own podcast, and the
when you tell everyone, just in case, like, where they need to be listening and all that good stuff.
And I apologize because I try to do it regular, but I do it wrong. I don't do the podcast correctly. I produce the fuck out of it, and it takes way too much time. That's why there's like two of them.
That's how you want it. That's how you want to do it.
But I unintentionally made a cliffhanger because I was going to do, usually it's just I do an episode. So I did, I was like, I'm going to do an autobiographical thing, and there'll be three episodes in a row, my childhood, and then the sort of young teen to young adulthood leading up to me leaving the Bay Area. And then the third one will be Welcome to Tinseltown when I came to LA.
Great. Right.
So that's where I'm stuck.
Oh no.
And relevant to what we're saying, I was going to reenact a moment that happened. The very first gig I did out here was a show called Comedy Product. And it was a stand-up show, but it evolved. There's a whole other story behind it. What it evolved out of was really, kind of what led to Mr. Show and all that stuff. Laura Milligan had a show here called Tantrum, and that's part of this episode too. I really want to talk about her because people need to know who Laura Milligan is.
Yeah.
Without her, I don't think the whole alternative comedy scene would be what it was.
She's
one of those people that no one knows.
The only people I hear talk about it are the people that were in that world, like Janine and Greg Barrett and like that. You know, there are some people.
Right. So I was in a band with her and Greg.
Yeah,
amazing. And that's what got me down here. She was doing these shows. And she said, come down and play keyboard for my shows and stuff. And that's what I would commute from San Francisco to LA for like a year doing those shows.
Amazing.
Anyway, so they finally were taking her show in perfect LA style of, here's Laura's show. She curated all this stuff. She got all these acts together. So we're going to make a show of it finally. But, you know, can we, let's get, Janine's big now. Let's get your friend Janine. They were very close friends.
Classic Tinseltown.
And it was almost like, should we even do, you know, and then, but it, they did the, and Janine was like, okay, make sure she's, you know, writer and producer on it. And yeah. Okay. So did it. And, so my job was almost nothing. I was the guy on the keyboard in the background. There was a couple sketches people did, and I played on those. And in the meantime, it was when they stopped down, setting up, like, ostensibly during a commercial break.
Right.
Then I'd play cheesy organ versions of, like, a Green Day song or whatever.
Yep.
So then afterwards at the rap party, this is the thing I was gonna, I'm planning on reenacting, so it's a spoiler.
I love it.
But this guy comes up to me and starts grilling me. Where did you study? Where were you trained?
Where do you summer?
Yeah, all that stuff. And I'm just like, really? And I was still vulnerable enough to let it really get to me.
Sure.
Like, I really felt like maybe I shouldn't be doing this for a living. I don't think I'm, I don't, I'm not studied enough. I don't have what it takes. I don't, you know, and it really was, it was kind of brutal at the time.
Yeah.
And then it was way after the fact, I'm like, really, do I need to really study counterpoint and know all about Beethoven to score the Autumn Breeze Deuce joke jingle that Tom Kenny just did that we wrote? And so,
should I really be haunted really need by to this worry right about now? That?
And it's also, I realized, the other thing was, you know, I do listen to a lot of classical music, and I have since I was a kid. And so I was also very, the idea of, you know, classical training, and I know not to poo-poo it at all, because holy moly, the real deal of classical training is unbelievable. And people who have gone through that are amazing musicians. But again, everyone's a different animal, though.
Yeah.
And again, without some of people like that, I wouldn't be able to get some of the music I have recorded right, because I need those guys to play this stuff, right? But I also realized, what's a music theory class besides a very fancy pants version of what me and my friends used to do when we'd sit around and get high and listen to a record and go, dude, check out that bass line.
Right.
Isn't that awesome?
Right.
And let's hear that again. What's he doing?
You're still learning. You're still, you're self-educating.
Except for you're doing,
Yeah,
except for you're doing it with much more complicated music.
Right. You
know, it's one thing to try to pick apart, you know, what Beethoven's doing versus, you know, Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But sometimes people go through that whole process and then talk about how they feel like they restricted themselves by not, you know, by being so, having such a formal education and then feeling like this sort of the opposite of, I think, what you feel vulnerable about sometimes, which is the sense of like, I'm afraid to break the rules, or I'm afraid, you know what
there's
I mean?
I
can't
it.
Hear it any other way than the way I was taught because it was so drilled into me. So it's like, it could be the grass is always greener too.
Absolutely. Cause that is the big problem is you start, and I was always worried about that. It's like, well, I won't be doing it right.
Yeah.
And I had to kind of go, there's no right way. Just do it.
Absolutely.
Do what you think is what you feel. And
I gotta say, I think that's amazing. That's amazing advice for our listeners. For me to, I can't believe this. I have now occupied an hour of your life, and I haven't even gotten into this MASH game. So I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna try to get
MASH game.
I mean, first of all, I love your enthusiasm. Second of all, I have a pen that is not working, so I'm gonna walk over here.
Oh, they never do when you need them.
I mean, what the heck?
I have an entire drawer full of pens in my studio, none of which work. Why do I even still keep them in the drawer? Like, as if by some miracle they're gonna change their mind.
Today's the day, everybody.
We're back. We were kidding.
Today's the day. Yeah, thank you for reminding me that I need to just like throw that away.
We just needed you to apologize
to us.
It has
to go away. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so for the first MASH category, I mean, listen, there are going to be some things that are not in any way surprising to anyone based on the things we've talked about, and I'm just going to get the ones that are screaming to be done out of the way first. The first one is there are 3 days of your life in this future of yours that you could imagine a person that you admire scoring that day. So it's a totally original new music. I don't know what that day looks like for you, but 3 composers that you sort of would like to say, like, okay, I want a day in the life of Eben as scored by.
As scored by, and pick 3 composers.
Yeah.
Do they need to still be alive?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Ennio Morricone's number 1, obviously.
With a bullet. Great.
Bernard Herrmann.
What has he scored? I'm embarrassed that I don't know, but I'd rather ask. Oh, great.
That's what he's most famous for, but my favorite Bernard Herrmann stuff is all the Ray Harryhausen movies.
Oh, okay.
okay.
Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah, yeah.
Jason and the Argonauts.
I learned something new. Is that I like Bernard Herrmann, Island. And I didn't even know I liked him.
Little trivia, that somehow Disney comes up with our circle of friends so much.
Yes, yeah.
There's a little snippet of the Mysterious Island music when I don't know, it's running now. It's not running right now, right? The Disneyland train, the railroad that goes around.
Oh, is it?
Star Wars is in the way.
Yeah.
But when you would go through where the dinosaurs were.
Yeah.
I remember going through there and psh, dun, dun, gong.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's Mysterious Island. Yeah.
That is a good piece of Disney trivia. I always like shoehorning in some Disney trivia. I'm very on board for that.
And then I'm going to throw in John Carpenter.
Great. 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 I'm so glad. I feel like that is the idea of like a Moog or like synthesizers, like the Stranger Things. Things that are new now, that we have clearly reached a point at which the place that we are pulling back from is the 80s, but right. I'm really happy about the synthesizer side of that. Like I remember what, like Bon Iver's album, not this last one, but the one before that. And he just like really jammed in with some synthesizer and some sort of like, is this Bruce Hornsby? But like said that there was some stuff going on there that I was like, I welcome it. Welcome it. I'm ready for it. Bring it to me.
It's wild how that's the stuff comes around.
Oh yeah, like clothes. Why wouldn't you know those other kinds of musical instruments?
It's going so fast though.
Stuff,
it used to be a actual. I know we got to do the thing, but it used to be sort of orderly. It's like when it was the 70s, we were into the 50s,
exactly,
and then in the 80s, we got into the 60s, and we kind of did that. But now it's all like. Everything
it's
is all multi-retro all at the same time.
I blame the internet, as we probably should and can.
Yeah, it's like...
I couldn't agree more.
Art Deco 70s kitsch from the 50s. Mm-hmm. What?
And that's why we're all slowly going crazy.
Yes,
or quickly.
We're losing our minds.
Okay, next is you wake up tomorrow with a practical skill. So it's not like a superpower per se, but the fact that you
not
have...
Not like healing my eyes.
Not like my special gift. I'm afraid many people can never have that. This is like, it can be absurd in the sense of like you wake up tomorrow and you can speak Chinese fluently, but it's not like you can wake up tomorrow and fly. You know what I mean?
Right.
The three skills would be fun to wake up tomorrow and be brilliant at.
Well, the language thing is definitely one that I'm constantly like, when do I do this? I want to speak Spanish.
Yeah.
I absolutely wish I could just speak fluent Spanish.
Yeah.
And I took 3 years in high school.
Yeah.
I should have paid better attention.
It's really tough when something's not, when you're not exercising that language muscle every day. It's just, it's really, really hard.
So that would be one.
Spanish is great.
I would love to, let's see. I would love to have good construction skills, know how to build things.
Mm-hmm, same.
Mechanical skills.
Great.
And then the last thing would be, let's see. Well, sight reading.
Oh, there you go. We could just knock that out right
if
here.
I could just do that in a day, why not?
Why wouldn't I? Perfect.
I'm so C. Jane Run with my sight reading, even now.
Yeah. I took classical guitar and I took piano before that. And I really did have to, you know, I had to learn sight reading for classical guitar, but it's also like this is when I was a child. So it's one note at a time.
Yeah.
So though, like a very rudimentary memory, but it's almost like I dreamed it where I'll look at a scale and I'll look at notes and I'll be like, okay, the note that is hollowed out, I know that means something different than the one with the little flag on it.
And what's that rule? F-A-C. Every time.
Counting every time.
What makes me go crazy, you know, with self-loathing and doubt and everything, is like, of course, I know what all the notes are.
Yeah.
I know what they all mean.
Yes.
I know what all the values are.
Yeah.
But my brain stops when it comes to you put it in front of me. It will not go in my eyes, into the brain, and out my fingers and
really
to hit
specific.
The right stuff.
It's just really
what
specific.
I found is the closest I've come to being a quick sight reader is with Theremin.
Mm.
And I will use a chart. And I'm not literally – here's where I'm cheating. I know the melody in my head. Like I did this with Vivaldi because I did a Vivaldi piece. And it has just enough changes where I'm like, well, it goes up at that one part.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the chart in front of me. I can follow along. I know where I'm at with the melody.
But it's because you already know.
But I already know the
match
melody.
Them
and so it's a reminder of like, here's, look, the note's going up there. That's where you go up. But I'm
totally.
Not literally hitting those. That process
that's how it is with
happening.
Me in singing. If it's something like it's a song I have to learn quickly. It's like, oh, sure. You can put the notes in front of me. That will sort of help me remember like, Oh, yes, it is going up,
but
like
really
I thought it was going
to. You're doing it by ear, and
totally.
It's a reminder guiding you along.
100%.
And so yeah, that level I can do. But and for a while there, I could actually write it way quicker than reading it.
Yeah.
When I was actually
That's really
taking
interesting.
Some music classes, and
Isn't
then I
that
lost
funny?
That because I don't do that anymore.
Well, listen, I didn't mean to bring us back down.
Anyway.
You yes. might end up with sight reading, so this could all get solved in a
That's
moment
right.
anyway.
But I'll need my eyes to be healing if I'm going to do that because they're
I'll
going
see what
the
I can
other
pass
direction.
Along. I'll see what I can impart upon you. next category is three places, but let's do fictitious places. So these are places that are impractical places. For you to have a vacation home. So that could mean the bottom of the ocean. It could mean Endor. It could mean Middle Earth. Three places that it's not realistic for you to have a vacation home in this life, in this reality.
Okay. Well, the first one is an Arctic science like the John Carpenter's The Thing science place.
Yes, great. What,
I love that movie so much that I'm willing to have a vacation there, even though clearly I'm going to die. But at least it will be cool.
To some haunting music, some very badass music, and some very slimy, wonderful practical effects.
And oh, by the way, this got me really pissed. Did you know that that soundtrack got a Razzie Award?
What?
Yeah.
It was ahead of its time.
Well, because everyone's so damn tin-eared and they're not paying attention, all they remember from the movie is the doom, 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 doom. So like, oh, that's easy. It's like, actually, I've recreated that track because I did a theremin track where I do Michael Jackson's Thriller on theremin, but in the style of the thing.
Great.
And so I went and listened to it.
Great.
And you think it's really, the chords are ever changing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not just two, and they're really interesting chords. And there's weird chordal movement in it.
Yeah.
And there's polyrhythms going on. The second rhythm that comes in on top of the doom.
Yeah. Dun, 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 no, dun, it's. Dun. So
it's,
evocative.
It's
it matches
way more complicated
how you are
you
supposed
think.
To feel about where they are and what is happening so perfectly. And that dissonance, that very elaborate, well, that very deliberate, I should say, dissonance is one of the things that puts you off a little bit. You know what I mean? Because it should be simple and it's not. So you're sort
and
of off
not.
Kilter.
And it's brilliant.
Brilliant.
And when you hear the whole track, how it expands and keeps building on the soundtrack album, fucking great.
Oh my God,
fuck
I have so
you
many.
And your Razzies.
I have so much music I need to get. Yeah, fuck you and your Razzies, guys.
Except for the ones I worked on a movie that got Razzies that deserved it. But anyway.
Oh, yeah? All right, well.
I shouldn't talk. It got me my studio.
Okay. Well, we'll leave that unnamed. Okay. Arctic
It'll be
Lab.
Obvious if you look at my credits.
There you go. Do a little research.
You'll go, oh, that piece of garbage. But that was a $40 million piece of garbage.
Oh, there you go.
I didn't get that, but, you know, it's enough for me to get my
head.
All right. Anyway, sorry off that little tangent.
No. I love it. Okay, so, yeah, Arctic Lab.
Arctic
is
Lab.
What I, is
oh,
what
yes.
I put in is to
Arctic
remind
Lab.
Myself that it's that universe, but.
I used to always want to be on Jacques Cousteau's Calypso.
Yes!
So I would like to just sail around, if Jacques could be back and if he could narrate my whole experience.
I love it. Okay, great.
And now we will have the vacation cake. Deep in it. Oh, gosh, one more. Tip top of, like, the, I guess, Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to climb there or deal with the air.
You like snow as much as I do, it sounds like.
Yeah, snow is cool.
I'm real into
driving in it.
I'm just into the way it looks and sounds.
I love being there.
Yeah.
And I don't like going to the snow. Like when my kids want to, we want to see snow. I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
I got to drive. I'm going to put chains on. Oh no.
It's so
and
different.
Once I'm there, it's like, this is awesome.
I
got to drive back. We're all going to, oh God.
Same. The practicals, not the way I feel about it. Emotionally is very powerful. But okay. And then next category, listen, all due respect to your wonderful wife. All due respect. One element of the MASH game is this sort of alternate universe, like romantic times.
I see.
And it can be a character from something. It can be a character from a book. It can be an actress from the 20s. Doesn't have to be grounded in this reality at all, but it's just kind of like, well, I did always have a crush on, you know, Meryl Streep circa blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
Three ladies that in this alternate universe is like romantic times.
Okay. First one would be the weirdest, if you could call it a crush.
I'm so excited about this.
One whole
whatever
aspect
it is.
Of my youth that we haven't gotten is how incredibly virginal I was.
Uh-huh.
There was a
such
recent,
a beautiful way. There was a poetic way of expressing that.
There was a recent spontaneous issue after this episode. I think we were rolling when you guys were talking about first kiss or something.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
And Paul was like, well, I was relatively late, junior in high school. I'm like, I got that beat by a mile. Try junior in college. Oh. Anyway, so during that time, I was completely smitten with Etta Del Orso. I think that's how you pronounce it. She's the singer that one of the singers, but one of the main singers that Ennio Morricone would use. So when you would, when you hear Once Upon a Time in the West, that soprano voice. Actually, that's, I just did the wrong score. That's Duck, You Sucker.
Okay.
But right. That's the one where that's the one where I started really losing my mind over her voice.
Yeah.
The score to Duck, You Sucker.
Oh my God.
That's the melody from it. And so I was just like, oh, I don't know what she looks like and I don't care.
That voice
is just like, I want to marry that voice.
Oh, that's amazing.
So then Claudia Cardinale.
Okay.
Because she's gorgeous. She's in Once Upon a Time in the West. And what solidified it is I'm watching a movie. That voice is singing every time you see this woman's face.
Pavlovian.
So now it's kind of like, okay,
you hear the melody, you salivate.
It's Claudia Cardinale.
That's amazing.
So
I love that those are linked that way.
And then let's see. I'd have to go. I don't know the character name. And let's skip the ending.
Yeah.
But the character that Diana Rigg played in the James Bond movie where he married her.
Oh, amazing! Amazing.
Without Diana her getting Rigg. Shot.
Diana Rigg.
Of course, if she's with me, she wouldn't get shot Bond. Because she wouldn't be with some spy.
That's exactly
She'd
right.
She'd be very bored.
Where she belongs.
But, you know.
Very safe.
Really? Are you just going to stay safe at home again? Bored. You're not going to chase anybody? Nothing? No,
I
just going to hang out.
Rigg.
But hey, at least we won't get shot.
Yeah.
All right.
There you go. You're all set.
Oh, boy.
Okay, this is one I always include because it's fun for me. I apologize if it's boring to you, but this is three foods that in this world are you're either allergic to or they're just too heavy to eat a lot of, but you wish you could eat a lot of, or rare enough that you're like, oh, that one pizza at blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. I wish I could just have that whenever I wanted it. Three foods, and then in this reality, these bad foods for you are actually like nutritious. So you can have them with zero health ramifications.
Really?
Three.
Okay. I haven't thought about this kind of thing much at all.
Yeah.
A black and tan with all Swiss milk chocolate ice cream from Fenton's.
Interesting. You know, you say black you haven't thought about it.
With all Swiss milk chocolate. That's the, if you ever go to Fenton's, I'm just telling you, if you order that, I can't imagine that you would have any smidgen of disappointment in you at all.
Okay, great.
So that's one.
Great.
What else would I, just ice cream. God, I would just eat, if ice cream was healthy, that's all I would eat.
Yeah, great.
The next thing I guess would be, ribs.
Great.
Emil Villa's Hickory Pit of old in Oakland was, oh my God, that place was the greatest.
Great.
So, ribs, and then, I'm trying to eat less fish as much as I love it.
Yeah.
Because it all has mercury in it. So
Same.
Let's put fish on the list.
Great.
And let's enjoy it while we can.
I love it.
Because I'm going to bring the whole podcast
down. We're
going to
all turn into Terminator 2.
By the time my kids are grown up, we probably won't have any fish that are not poisoned left to eat. We'll have to, you know, maybe farm-raised salmon will still be okay. I don't know.
I'm crossing my fingers. Okay.
Yes.
Next category is three. I have a special. This is from my friend Chuck Bryant, who does the Stuff You Should Know podcast. And he actually has a forthcoming podcast that I will be excited to announce when he starts releasing it. I don't think he has yet. But he texted me the other day saying, oh, I know this is super nerdy, but I just thought of a category. I thought of a MASH category that I think would be fun. And so his category, I think we've done something close to it, but not actually done it, which is three TV families that in this alternate universe you get to join.
That I get to be a part of the family?
So it could, and it could just be like, you know, it doesn't have to be some huge family. It's not all Eight is Enough.
Clearly, Eight is Enough. I loved that show when I was a kid. But clearly the family from Lost in Space.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Then you get out in space, too.
Billy Mummy's other brother.
Great. Okay, Lost in Space.
That's one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. You know what? I'm going to go with Eight is Enough.
Great.
Now that you mention it, because that really was for me. that show was big to me. And I remember they had their episode about getting drunk. There's an episode where the brother got drunk.
Of course they have to have the get drunk episode.
I had just gotten drunk without my parents knowing and was really hungover, and that was on. I felt really guilty.
That's what they wanted.
It was just like,
that's what the show wanted.
What are they doing? I'm going to say the Brady Bunch.
Great.
Great. I'm not ashamed.
Nor should you be. Nor should you be. I've made a lot of fun with those families.
That's been covered with them, the new Brady Bunch movies, now that I think about it.
I think they did such a great job with those. They did such a great job with those. I talk about those more than I should. I'm always like, have you not seen it? It's so charming.
I love it.
They're really great.
And then when I first came to LA, I was catering with Henriette Mantel.
Oh my gosh. Well, there you go.
So we had some, there was some couple fun stories there.
Oh, that's great.
She's fantastic. She's so great. Hilarious.
I love that. Okay. Second to last category is three... Let's do three movies that you can jump into and be in, and be in, you're safe. Nothing's bad's going to happen to you, but you can just live inside that world and just be with those characters and just have that whole feeling of that movie. Three.
Okay. I'm glad you said the safe part.
Yeah, so then nothing bad will happen to you, so you can go as violent as you want. You're not going to get shot. You're not going to get a disease.
I'm like thinking back all my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say it again. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Great.
I want to hang out with MacReady and go, I'm going to be the guy in the room when he's doing the blood test. I'm going, no, let's listen to him. He's right. Yes. Let's not argue with him.
Yes.
And of course, he'll do my blood and I'll turn into a thing and I'm fucked. But, you know, but I'll be safe because we have this rule.
That's right. That's right.
That's all right. The next one, I saw both these movies the same day, opening day, best movie going day of my life. So with John Carpenter's The Thing goes Blade Runner.
Oh, God, what a day.
That was awesome. We saw Blade Runner first.
Amazing.
Argued our way into the theater.
Amazing.
The guy didn't want to let us in. And we're like, we've seen Dawn of the Dead. Is there anything worse than that?
Good for you.
And then he let us
in. Oh, you really debate teamed your way in there. Oh, that's fantastic.
Oh, we totally did. And so I said, John Carpenter's a thing. I did Blade Runner.
Blade Runner.
I already did John Carpenter, so I won't do Escape from New York. I will.
This is your game.
I'm going to go ahead and say Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Why wouldn't I?
Why not? Get a
Western. I want to be in the Spaghetti West. In the old Spaghetti West, one version of it or another.
I love it. That's great. Okay, and then final category for you. Let's do. I like this one sometimes. Let's do. You have an extra room in your house that is. There's no actual physical blueprint that's visible to the naked eye, but there is this sort of special secret door, Harry Potter style, where you can open it up and it serves some purpose in your house, and it can be a practical purpose or it can be a completely fantastical purpose. But three.
Okay, first one. When I was a kid, I always wanted a room that was an entire, just wall to wall and ceiling aquarium.
Great, great.
So it's just fish all around you. Then next thing, I would love to have a full balls to the wall tiki room.
Great, 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 great.
Like basically like the one at Disneyland.
Yes.
Even
just
more
transformative.
Like that's not even tiki enough.
It would shame that tiki room. Like it's about shaming that tiki room.
We could have done a lot more with this. Yeah. Look what he did in there. I wanted like that.
Great.
Let's see. And then, let's see.
God, that's so fun. That made me think of a new category that could be like a ride in Disneyland that converts into some room in your house. Like whatever right, that means to
instead
you.
Instead of letting you out of the gift shop.
Yeah.
I'm in my living room. How nice. Yo, ho, yo, it's time for dinner. Okay.
Exactly. Let me just gather up my jewels, my treasure. Okay. Aquarium, tiki room.
A super game room.
Great. Super game room. Okay.
Pool tables, video game, like an mini arcade.
Yeah. I love that. That's, boy, these are really great. Evan, you kind of kicked this thing's ass. Okay. And then I'm going to do that little thing where I just do like the little spiral. So just tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. I'm going to pause it, do some quick calculations is maybe a strong word for what I'm about to do. I'm going to come back with your 100% guaranteed fictitious future.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right, hope I'm
not at all. Not at all. And so just remind us, just tell us about your podcast for a second, just while we're thinking about it, because I know you and I both got off on a tangent about that.
Okay.
Which you can't do right now.
Oh,
because I'm already recording. Surprise.
Oh, okay. So, first of all, so yes, I did the worst tangential non-plug for my podcast. It's called Fantastical Musicorium, And it's the place where I put all of my own music. So, because what I do for a living is I cater to other people's needs, and I love doing it because I'm very lucky that I work on stuff that I like most of the time.
You guys, spoiler alert, he scored Stand Against Evil season 1.
Well, I was going to say, because this is a funny, this is a weird thing. It's like, and because I'm literally, after we leave here, that's what I'm working on.
Oh, nice.
When I walk out of here.
Oh, yay.
And it makes for a weird experience because, like, I feel like I've seen you all week.
Oh,
because I've been watching
I'm
you
so sorry.
All week. And it's a weird, I mean, and then it's probably, is that creepy? He's like, yeah. When you go to sleep tonight, I will literally be watching you. And I've had times where, like, I work on a project and I'm seeing somebody and then I realize I've never met this person. I can't just walk in and go, hey, there's a, no, I right. don't know you.
Well, welcome to Hollywood though. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, we all sort of think we know some, it's like, did I work with them? Have I just watched them in things? Have I been editing their thing? Have
and
I,
cause there's yeah. that familiarity when you, especially I think like editors and people, yeah. you know, cause I'm,
oh, yeah.
I'm not just I'm watching scenes that you've done more times than you ever even want to see them because I'm having to go back and go, oh, let me get that timed right. And
it's so got to be a good sign that you're still willing to sit down in front of me and talk.
50. No, it's like, it's great. I'm like, oh, now we get to actually have a conversation. And I'm blowing my podcast plug again.
Okay. Fantastical Musicorium is a place where you get to put your own music that's come from your heart. It's not tailored to anyone else's work. It's just coming right from you.
And in terms of, and I've still wrestled with what exactly the format is, and it kind of has evolved over time. There's not that many episodes. I think I'm now up to 10.
Yeah.
11 is sitting there waiting for me to have time to finish it. I inadvertently did a total cliffhanger with my 3-part autobiographical.
Listen, make them work for it. I don't know what that means. Make people work for it by wanting it, I guess.
So the best thing to do is subscribe to it because
then
otherwise...
Then you'll just get it, guys. It'll just come magically and
you won't have to check. Or follow
it'll
me on Twitter
because
then I'll say something about it. But it's going to be a long time in between episodes. But hopefully they're worth it. And for what it's worth, I'm putting like all the best stuff of all my records... all out there for free. It's like, that's by the time it's done, it'll be like everything I've done is just there. So
it's so amazing.
Anyway, hope
that's a gift, guys. You'd be fools not to take advantage of it. All due respect to you, my wonderful listeners. Don't be fools. Okay, I'm going to give you these MASH results.
Yes,
it was a doctor's test. I am very pleased with these results. I think you will be too. Some of these things kind of seem like they go together for me. I don't know. So I'm going to try to stitch everything into kind of one big story that we're going to tell, which is...
Please let the black and tan... Go on.
I'm going to have to rip that Band-Aid off quick.
No, it's all right. Oh, no.
First of all, I want to say although you love spending time with your 8 is Enough family, it is a big crowd of people.
Yes.
So
no,
sometimes
right.
you need to just get away.
Yeah.
And you have a few different ways that you can do that. Ooh. Not the least of which, I think we both know that the Arctic Lab that you did receive as a location, as described, is inherently a shack. So it's not surprising that you ended up not with a mansion or apartment or house, but with a shack.
With a shack.
You've got your Arctic shack getaway.
Excellent.
In the freezing cold. Because you can step into the thing at will. Right. So not only can you just have it as your vacation home and just sort of be there alone or with Etta de Morceau.
Or Etta Del Orso. Yeah.
Del Orso. I totally wrote it wrong.
Apostrophe Orso.
Etta
Del Orso.
Del Orso.
I don't know how you pronounce that in Italian.
You can ask her yourself because you are going to be in this Arctic blizzard environment with her beautiful voice.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, how lovely.
With or without other members of the thing because, as I said, you have the ability to go into that movie.
All those dudes are cool by me.
Right?
Every guy in that movie is such a great character
and
actor.
And all the dogs that don't eat people are also, huskies. Who can
good
go wrong? Now, if anything goes wrong there, worry not because you are an expert at construction and mechanical items.
That's perfect. Oh, yes.
Right? You can troubleshoot.
Oh,
you can
yes.
troubleshoot with no problem. and say something breaks down and you're having to fix it, rest assured you're going to be accompanied by Bernard Herrmann. Who will be scoring this adventure that you have that day. And this is a little weird, but listen, you do also have next to the shack, your extra room inside the shack, but sort of adjacent to it is your room that's an aquarium where, I mean, listen, I don't know if this is where you're getting it, But you do have an unlimited supply of perfectly healthy fish. They're all connected. It's so weird how this happened. You have the aquarium room and you can eat unlimited healthy fish.
The healthy fish is important in that environment because how do I know I'm not eating one of those things?
That's true. You got your own. It's like you're in a little space pod. You've got your own like biosphere that you're living out of.
That makes sense, actually. And for me, when I had three little aquariums in my room. I always was really into fish. And I always had the weirdest. I never had normal fish. It was all like weird freshwater flounder. Uh-huh. I couldn't just have a crab. It had to be a fiddler crab with one big claw and one little one. So yeah, it makes sense. It'd be all these weird, creepy, that's a half dog, half fish thing.
Yeah, there
you go. Floating around there. But it's healthy.
Yeah, there you go. So this is amazing. Those are your MASH results. This has been such a pleasure. Evan, thank you so much for doing this.
The only painful thing that's left
is your, if you would like to do whatever iteration of even just one sentence from Boys of Summer.
Oh, yes.
That will, I will live up to my own dedication to do that to myself.
I appreciate that. And I don't know it.
You were too cool to know it. And I applaud you for that. I salute you.
I don't know if it was cool, just out of touch. And I was just like, screw all. I'm not listening to rock of the 80s. I'm closing doors to cultural influence that makes me mad for whatever dumb reason I'm mad at everybody. Me.
I like that guy. I like that your voice sounded like that back then.
I guess I'll read it since I don't know the melody.
Just read a little piece of it and your dramatic interpretation of it.
I can see you. Your brown skin shining in the sun. You got that top pulled down and that radio on, baby. And I can tell you, my love for you will still be strong. Well, after the Boys of Summer have gone. This guy's got to get out of my living room first. How am I going to?
Some gentle honking. Oh my God. Okay, Evan, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Such a blast. Guys, I will talk to you next time on the podcast. I hope you're having a wonderful summer.
Screw it. Now leaving Nerdist.com.